Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Kelly Williams on the show. Kelly is an owner and instructor at Tower Yoga, a fantastic studio located here in Fresno. I thought it would be great to start the year off with a fitness conversation. A lot of us set fitness goals for the year. Some of those last longer than others. But I think finding something, some kind of activity that really not only enhances your fitness ability, but your mindset, I think is just as important. And so we dig into kind of a holistic picture of yoga in this conversation. I know you'll love it. Let's meet Kelly.
Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best. Fresno's best.
Kelly, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Home. But I know the question's more about supporting probably businesses in town, so I will let you know some of the things that I really like. I like at Java, the bakery, if it's more of a breakfasty or early lunch thing. I really like their like Lebanese dishes, and there's a Moroccan harissa with okra and white rice and some Arabic coffee, and I like the vibe. And I love Brahma Bowl, which is like Sean Mark's area. They're more like Southern Indian. There's a lot of places that have a lot of like North Indian dishes and things like that. So it's the only one in town that I feel that I like love to eat at most of the time, although I love Indian food in general. Let's see, Modo. I just got back from there in Fresno High area.
Like most of us.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Brahma Bowl because I love Indian food too. What do you order there?
I like to go to their buffet like around lunchtime.
You know what? I think I've maybe been to the buffet one time. Yeah, it's ringing a bell now.
It's a little pricey, but it's worth it. And you can eat as much as you want. So you definitely want to go if you're hungry. But I like they have idli, which is these like little rice kind of cakes that you have with soup called sambar. And when I was in India, I ate that a lot at like breakfast time. It was like a savory breakfast. And I've always been a savory breakfast person. I love that. Yeah. And I like the environment and the people are really sweet. And yeah.
Yeah. Fresno is great in that we have such great strip mall food. It's almost like I was talking to somebody about this recently, how we need almost like better food maps of the city, because you have these places that kind of just like you drive past it and you're like, okay, it's right next to a place where they sell cigarettes. On the other side is a payday loan. And you're like, is this really a place that I want to jump into food wise? But they're all hidden in there. And like, you can honestly wander into almost any strip mall in Fresno and find interesting food. And I think that's one of the coolest things is when you stumble on a place and find something that you really like.
Yeah, I would love if someone food mapped. That would be great.
Yeah. So I go to yoga. I talk about yoga with a lot of people. So this conversation is going to be a lot of fun for me. We're going to go all over the place when it comes to yoga and running and a few different things. But I want to start with kind of early experiences. So what was your first experience with yoga?
My first experience with yoga was actually in junior high. My cross country coach was leading some stretches before some meets. We would lay down and essentially do some body scanning, like meditation. She at the time wasn't calling it like yoga and body scanning and stuff like that, because that was just before it became like really acceptable.
Yeah.
So there weren't parents calling and being like, what are you teaching my kid? But when I started to get into yoga when I was like 15, 16, I actually saw on TV, it was called the Gayam channel, and they were these yoga classes. I would get into doing some of them, and then it brought me back to being like 12, 13 and going, oh, I was doing this. But that really was like my first exposure. And then 15, 16, it was something that was something I was interested in from more of a like philosophical kind of lens. So my very first like serious boyfriend was really into the Beatles. Like he was like, you have to like the Beatles. And I remember gravitating towards George Harrison. He was like the spiritual one of the bunch, although I know they were all in the 60s, like doing that let's go to India thing. But he was really, I was hearing these lyrics and I was thinking, what does this mean? And then I got into it and it was something that through, because I came from being an athlete or doing dance movement in my body, and I started getting really interested in going like, how do I understand my place in the world? And I didn't have a lot of traditions and those sort of things to understand myself and my place in it. So I was like grasping and searching, I think, for meaning.
Yeah.
And those collided in that perfect, really influential time of like fifth. And yeah, that's how it sparked and started. I haven't stopped ever since.
Yeah. Let me ask you a few more questions along those notes. And this is something I think about a lot. Do you think your standard average PE teacher should teach yoga?
Should, I don't know if I would use that word, but that's probably just like getting into semantics.
I think you're latching onto the should part, which is what I was leading with that. Because I do wonder, sometimes you'll get a teacher that shows you something, but is maybe not adept in the craft, if you will. And they might show you things that are out of context and don't make sense. So I guess what I'm asking is, you know, should we be teaching yoga in schools, or should the average PE teacher feel like they need to?
No, I don't think so. I think meeting the group of students that you have and where they're at, it could be a really beautiful thing, depending on like the group and the willingness and all that kind of stuff. I think movement in general, breath to movement specifically, is like what should be happening, if anything should be happening. If you want to call it yoga, great. If not, now, of course, there's a thing of appropriating versus appreciating and all these things that we could talk about. But I think that there's many ways to deliver these kinds of practices that help, that if you put labels on it can get in the way.
Yeah.
So I think like an introductory to some like breathing, even if it's like basic, like box breathing or just belly, deep diaphragmatic breathing and moving and stretching in your body. Of course, I think movement and breath are really important pieces of a big pie that is what we need. We need the whole pie for, I think, wellness. And then, yeah, if someone is straight up teaching sequences and very specific, then I think, yeah, let's respect where that came from and share that. But yeah, if it's a group of 11, 12 year olds, and if you try to call it yoga and this and that makes them not want to do it, then.
Yeah, we don't want it to be a turnoff, especially in middle school.
Yeah.
So you're someone that works in kind of the fitness space, athletic space. I'm curious your thoughts about specialization with kids in sports. Do you think that's a good or bad thing?
Specialization. Can you say more on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of kids in high school and middle school, they get involved with club sports and they play one sport throughout. They get really specialized equipment. They join travel teams. And so a lot of athletics is introduced to kids in middle and high school as something where you need to hone in on a single craft. As someone that works in the fitness space, what do you think about that kind of philosophy?
I think it's two things. On one side, it's very limiting for someone to be able to explore and express and that kind of thing. And on the other side, you do need to put a lot of hours into one thing to get good at it. And I can think about, just for one little example, I rode a mountain bike regularly for a few years before I actually ever enjoyed it. And that enjoyment only came after the discipline. So there's this thing of like flow follows form kind of thing. And so I can get that, but it's hard. That sort of happened to me when I was young. And then I had to choose between, first it was just sports or dance. And then I really wanted to make my dad proud. So I was like, okay, sports, even though dance was like my thing. And then in the sports world, it was like, okay, now you need to, as I got older, you need to like hone in on one, because the other one conflicts or whatever. And then by the time I got to that like 15, 16 year old age, this doesn't happen to everyone, but for me, I was like, I don't even like this. I don't. And now I'm good at it because I did it and I focused on it. And now I feel like I have to do it because I'm good at it, but I don't even like it. It literally, I don't even care about it.
Yeah. It's really tough, because I think in a lot of ways, you do have to specialize if you want your kid to get, quote, playing time, because it's so competitive now that if they don't focus, if they just want to take a buffet style approach to fitness or sports, They're just not going to get the kind of exciting times on the field that the kids that specialize do. And I think that's harmful. I think it's negative generally, because I want kids to sample more personally as they're growing up to figure out what they enjoy and not overuse certain muscle groups that could harm them for the long term. Now, I want to ask you, let's imagine that you're going to teach two different yoga classes with the same flows. One is to a group of 12-year-olds and one is a group to a group of 50-year-olds. What would be the biggest difference between those two classes?
The biggest difference would be how I present the theme. So the language and so the intentions, like I would try to make it a little bit more age appropriate, maybe a little bit more palatable for the 12-year-olds and the 50-year-olds. But at the same time, it would depend. Are those 50-year-olds people that come all the time, or are they new students? Then I might teach the same exact class as I would the 12-year-olds. So I think that would be the main thing. And I feel like I'm a pretty, like, I can be very deep and intense, but I'm a very, like, playful, bubbly person. So maybe I would be a little bit more, like, on the kind of jokey fun side with the younger and keep that, but also be like, all right, let's also get serious. I don't know. Dude, that's a really good question. I thank you for asking that. I have to think about that more.
Of course. Let's jump into a bunch of yoga practice and yoga teaching questions. Anytime you go to a yoga class, you're always going to hear something along the lines of related to modification. If you don't feel comfortable with this pose, do this. Now, if you were designing a class, and I guess my question is broad, but I'll ask it. If you had to err on the side of the beginners in the room modifying or the advanced students in the room modifying, who do you think it's more important to modify? If you were, you usually get modifications for the beginners, right? That's typically what I hear. If you can't do this, then here's an alternative way. I hear less, hey, if you're super advanced, do your headstand or whatever.
That's funny. I am the reverse, what you hear less.
Oh, okay.
I'm like, yo, if you can do wheel, do it. Don't wait for me. You're going to do it yourself. You're on your own. And I'll even be like, especially if it's something that is a little bit more where there is the almost risk factor is a little higher. I'm like, and if you've done it more than 2, 3, 4, 5 times, and you know that you can safely guide yourself in and out, go for it. Yeah, I think I've been teaching for about 15 years. And so I came from a space of more of what you're talking about. If you can't do this, then this. And I still like that I teach very progressively, meaning I teach the bones of the posture first, and then I slowly layer it. That's a lot of us at Tower Yoga, it's how we teach. And more so though, I'll stick with the average of the room, if you will, and then knowing those other people, it's all be like, and feel free and go for it if you want. And those people typically are already doing it. So
there's always that one guy or girl in the room who's doing the headstand while the rest of us are like barely trying to do crow. And you're like, come on.
I know.
And I know we're not supposed to compare, but we're also animals. So if you were to practice yoga in your baggiest sweatpants or your tightest Lululemon pants, do you think there's an actual qualitative difference to your performance? Or is that something that's just like the expected attire these days?
It depends on what style it is. If it's like a kind of regular vinyasa or kind of some sort of flow, more active class, I definitely would want to do some kind of tighter legging, Lululemon or not. And I just know for me that if I'm less distracted and trying to make sure that my top isn't going somewhere or my pants aren't falling down or things like that, then I can focus a little bit more. Or if I feel more comfortable in my body, say I am wearing a pair of tight pants that kind of hug me in a little bit more and I don't have to be like, oh, is this rolling down or is this happening? Then I can stay in my own practice and in my body a little bit more. But I do think that there's an expected attire sometimes when you like walk into a space and you feel it, because if you're not wearing it, you're like, oh.
Yeah, there's a culture. Yeah, there's a culture and a uniform almost.
I just want to feel like I'm not like pulling and moving my clothes around. And I get that sometimes when students walk in where they're like, I don't care what I'm wearing. But at the same time, too, I see their whole practice. They're fidgeting with what they're wearing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So reducing distractions. There was a while, because I feel like the yoga equipment for women is obviously quite a bit more developed than it is for men. And I would wear these Lulu shirts, which they, I don't know what it is, but they become dresses so fast where they just get really long parachute style. And then I would be doing downward dog and it would shoot over my face. And so just like my whole midsection is exposed and I can't see anything. It's just very uncomfortable. And so
off.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Sometimes people aren't comfortable with that and that's totally okay. But yeah, it's that thing where it's turning to a dress. It's like covering up your face and down dog. It's just as long as you're comfortable, I'm like, take it off. But you have to be comfortable with that, of course.
Sure. Do you think fitness trackers have helped or hindered people's yoga practice?
You're probably going to catch a theme here. I'm always like, I can see both sides.
Yeah, no. It depends is always the best answer. But I ask it either or to make it exciting.
In a large part, I can see it hindering people checking their watches and this and that. I think if you just turn it on and turn it off and you don't mess with it, great. And it's helping you understand how your body is operating and you're putting that against like your sleep and this and that. Great, because it's giving you more information. And if you're using that information to make good decisions for your life and it's improving your life, great. But I see people like mess with it, look at it. And also I've even felt it myself. It's not like as much of a fitness tracker, but I have a watch that I put my courses on and things for like when I run and that sort of thing. And I was trying to do it in like my yoga too, because I was like, okay, cool, it's all going to my Strava, the fitness app. And then I would just feel, oh man, if I forgot to start my watch, I'm like, oh no, that practice didn't count or something. It was really weird. And I practiced for so many years. Who cares? I do think sometimes people share stories of their metrics and stuff, and it's exciting and it's an accountability thing. And they feel proud of themselves and it helps them stay on track in their own lives. That's great. But I also think then it's just another system that we have to deal with of the numbers and the likes and the metrics. And it's, man, can't this be 1 hour or whatever out of your day where you're just going in and who cares if anyone knows?
Yeah, there's a whole other podcast just about that subject itself. For you, what are the attributes of a good yoga student?
We can talk about
the attributes of a quality teacher all day, but I'm curious on the reverse. For you, what are the memorable students that you just love teaching?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The memorable students are the ones that show up on time and ready and are open to not just like the physical postures, but engage during the little like Dharma talk or whatever that I'm doing in the beginning to set the stage. And that are curious, that show themselves grace, me as well, myself, and who are at least where there's like an intention to check in. Yeah, that's the most memorable students to me, like the ones who are there with this like curiosity and grace and like dedication, who are like in it. And I can feel it, like we're so in it. And if we like happen to catch glances and it's just like, we know we're in it. I love that. Yeah, I love that.
How much do you personally think about your breath during a yoga session?
If I'm practicing?
Yeah. So if you were taking the class from someone else and you were thinking about your breath, how often would it come front of mind?
Yeah, I just did this morning. I took a class from one of our teachers here. I'm thinking about it the whole time. And sometimes it's a problem where then I'm just like thinking about my breath. And then we've done a bunch of postures and it's, so then it's almost a distraction rather than the tool to help me stay in my body. So I actually am on the side of where I probably am like a little too intense about it, or I could just be like, yo, just inhabit the posture, have fun and be in it. So I think about it a lot and I think about, oh, is it too loud? Is it loud enough? And then it's, oh, this is not a performance. That happened to me today. I had to remind myself, you're not performing for anyone here. Why are you thinking, is it too loud or too quiet? And because I wasn't thinking about it for me. I was like, everyone else around me. I think about it too much.
On that note, I've just been reading a book about good errors that are edifying for you, mistakes that you make that help you propel yourself forward. For you, what are good errors in learning yoga?
In the physical practice?
Yeah, like what are the most generative mistakes you can make in a yoga session?
I think one of the best errors you could make is allowing yourself to fall or to try and not get it, with air quotes, right? I think that's one of the best errors that a student can make, not to over push themselves to hurt themselves, but to actually explore that line and to let themselves be vulnerable enough to like fall out of the tree pose or go a little too far and crow or something like that, to let themselves just go, oh, whoops, whoopsie. Best air ever. And those people, there's this one student I had. She came to class and she's trying to do these handstands, trying to handstands, asking me all these tips. And she's just, I don't recommend this, okay, but she's just falling backwards. She's like doing all, and it was like embarrassing, but then I loved it. I loved it that she didn't care who saw embarrassing falls, where it was just like, oh, people are like, shit. And, but she just, you know what? She didn't care because she wanted to learn the handstand. It didn't matter that she looked a little silly, because she did, honestly, but it was amazing. And I think it was really liberating for a lot of people. But she ended up getting that handstand like very quickly. And I've had some students I've had for years and years who they do the drills, they do the this, they do the that, but they don't let themselves like test that edge. And they hold themselves back because maybe it's there's something that they feel is really scary. What will happen if they fall? If someone sees them or I don't know. But then another student who I had is like, how'd she learn that so fast? And I'm like, honestly, it's because she fell like over and over.
It's very similar, I feel like, in learning a new language. If you're too cautious to try, if you're like trying to learn Spanish and you walk into a taqueria in Fresno and you're too nervous to order in Spanish, you're never going to really see any improvement because you actually have to get in there and fail, be corrected by someone who's fluent, and then learn as you go. And I think that for me, I think that's across the board in learning domain. Now, speaking of learning, I've told this story a couple times and I'm going to tell it again because I don't care. When I first started really doing yoga, it was when I lived in Southern California and I went to a snooty place, a very snooty place. And it was me and kind of women between the ages of 40 and 60 that, you know, they rolled up in their Audis or whatever. And I have body hair. And so I sweat quite a bit. And I remember in the middle of class, everyone was doing really well. And the yoga teacher comes up to me and she's like, I forget what she said exactly. She said, honey, I can see how much you're sweating. You're working too hard. Why don't you think about child's pose for a little while? And I was like, oh, I was like, I felt so shamed. And I'm just like, girl, this is how my body sweats. Anyway, so I say that all to say, when you're thinking about correcting people, there's always the danger of shame, right? People feel shame when they're not doing things correctly. But if you don't correct people, it's hard to learn. So how do you think about that dynamic in your teaching practice?
Yeah. I first and foremost like to lead with curiosity. So if I notice something where there's like a major kind of misalignment happening, first I step back and I'm like, okay, do I know this person? Do I know their practice? Are they new or not? They could have a bunch of things going on in their body, which is why they're like holding the posture in a way that maybe I'm not inviting. So I first make sure I like assess the situation to get as much information as I can before approaching.
Yeah.
And then I go lead in with curiosity. So I'll ask a question first. Can you bend your knee a little bit more here or whatever? And then they yeah, of course. And they just didn't know, or they're like, no, I had a knee replacement. You know what I mean? Or something like that. And so that's how I approach it. And if someone's really new and there's a lot going on, they're new to the environment, all these kinds of things, I don't mind letting someone, for lack of better words, like flail a tiny bit as long as they're not hurting themselves. Because it's, yeah, I'm not going to sit there and be like, and your wrists and your gaze and your knees and your hips, and then be like, God, I'm never coming back. I'm just not perfect enough. So now if there's something where I'm like, oh, whoa, like your knee and toes are like on the same foot going a different direction, then of course I'll go. But I try to go in with as much information before even approaching. And then I lead with a question and that helps me feel it out. And I really keep it ball in their court where I'm like offering suggestions. Yeah. Unless someone looks like they're really going to hurt themselves or they're about to pass out or something, then those are emergency situations where I'm like, whoa, breathe.
Absolutely. Yeah. Kind of building on that. And this is a question I posed to another yoga teacher, Leanna Pierce at Four Corners. And she had an interesting response. I'm curious about yours. How do you think about pain and discomfort? So like one of my favorite types of yoga to practice is like vinyasa, where you're holding poses for extended periods of time. And you could get to that point where you're just like, I am so uncomfortable right now. And it's a weird world, right? Because you need to listen to your body, but sometimes your body tells you information or tells you stories that maybe are going to get in your own way of growth. And so how do you think about pain and discomfort in the yoga studio space?
I'm a fan of discomfort in the yoga studio space, but not pain. Look, sitting with pain is really important. Meditating is one of the most painful things physically that I do. And I try to sit alongside that pain, almost like a friend, without trying to change it. Now, in a posture or something, if there is something that is sharp or shooting that it feels like it's dangerous because of the way I've oriented my body or the way I'm engaging or not engaging my muscles, of course, it's, hey, back off. But I think that it hurts to be in a body. It really does. And the more you don't distract yourself and you just sit with it, it's painful. But especially as you get like a little older and that kind of thing, I have done a few Vipassana courses or the 10-day meditation courses. And I really realized through both those experiences, it's painful. It's painful. And we're so distracted left with beautiful things. Distraction doesn't have to be a negative thing, but we have so much going on. But the quieter you become and the more still you become, there's a reason why movement is so powerful. Mm-hmm. So I think sitting with pain, as long as there's nothing that is danger zone, and then discomfort, I'm a huge fan of discomfort because I think that's where like growth happens. Now it's like how we manage and hold the discomfort and take care of it is really important. There's always like the thing in yoga, it's like your edge, go to your edge. You'll hear a teacher say that. And really what they're saying is yoga happens in the place between effort and ease. And so I always try to help have people, if I'm putting them to a posture, it's okay, now like effort more in here. Now try to make it as easeful as you can. Somewhere in between is your unique blueprint. Go with that.
Yeah, I've got a mantra that I repeat to people all the time, which is choose your pain or it'll choose you. And I say this after I'm a runner like yourself, and I have this weird practice where I like to, in summers in Fresno, I like to go for runs in the middle of the afternoon when it's at its hottest.
My husband does that. You're crazy people.
Yeah, I don't recommend it. Don't do it, basically, is what I'm saying. But it works for me because the rest of the year, when I'm running outside right now, like it's the pressure of running when it's at the hottest really flexes my, that kind of edge space. And I've felt like I can really do anything after I've done something like that. But anyway, that's a whole story about sadism, really. Let's talk about something else, which is yoga in many ways is a spiritual practice. What percentage of people do you think go through actual spiritual change through their yoga practice in your experience?
I would say most people, if they're coming and they're very consistent in their practice, will go through some kind of spiritual transformation. It might not mean that like their whole life is completely changed up or whatever, but I do see that for those people who come and they show up consistently, that all of a sudden, all kinds of things shift and change. First, like I'll notice physically and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then as I get to know them and they maybe share a little bit more about this, that, and whatever, their jobs, their relationships, their all kinds of things. Yeah. And then you have the small percentage, I think, of where even the ones that come consistently, it's like going to the grocery store. It's like checking it off the box and okay, that's okay. There's that too.
Yeah. We're all on our own journeys. Are there any injuries that should dissuade someone from practicing yoga? Are there certain physical issues that people have where maybe yoga isn't the right fit? Or do you think it could be practiced by anybody?
I think that yoga can be practiced by anybody. I don't think it's for everybody. And there's so many different styles offered that I do think that no matter kind of what you're working with on the physical plane, there is going to be some kind of style or approach that will be accessible. Here's even like my grandma before she passed away was doing chair yoga. Mm-hmm. So it's there's restorative, there's all kinds of different things, but I've just been practicing for long enough. And early on, I'm like, everyone, the world would be a peaceful place. World peace would happen if everyone did yoga. But what I realize is that yoga is it's like a medium. And that's what it is. Yoga is a medium, and people are practicing yoga all the time, calling it by another name and through a different approach. Yeah, it might not be the thing that lights someone up. It might not physically be the thing that works for them. It might not emotionally and mentally and psychically be the thing that brings them kind of peace and all that sort of stuff. So I do think, I honestly think it can be practiced by anybody, but it's not for everybody.
Okay.
There's other things, yeah.
All right, we're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you. Tell me whether you think they're overrated or underrated and why.
Okay.
So we'll start with one that's around the corner from you. Me and Ed's Pizza, over or underrated?
You're gonna be so annoyed with me, but neither.
It's properly rated.
It's properly rated. I don't think it's underrated because it's so good and everyone knows it, or most people know it. But I wouldn't say it's overrated because then that would be like, oh, it's more hype than it's worth. I'm also from Fresno, so me and Ed's is like in my blood, probably. I like it. I think that it's not underrated, it's not overrated. It's solid. There's
Okay.
certain locations I don't like, but we don't need to get into that.
Yes, I've had many discussions with people about the hierarchy of me and Ed's
Oh,
locations.
there is a hierarchy for sure.
All right, next one, ice baths.
Ooh, okay. I would say overrated in the like mass media, but underrated in like my friend groups.
Okay. Can you say more?
I feel, and maybe it's just on my algorithms and things like that, but it's all like Wim Hof and this and that and the ice bath and all these kinds of things. And I'm like, okay, yeah, we know it's like good for you and you got to do the breath and the this and the that. In my kind of circles, people are like, that's freaking crazy. You're taking a cold shower. That's crazy. I did this challenge last year for a month. I would wake up, drink some like salt, magnesium, potassium thing, chug it, go 1 minute, get in the freezing cold shower. It's different than the ice bath, but that's what I would do at home. And then right away, get dressed for a run and go outside and just try to take in like the early light. And it was so good, but I did get fatigued. And then I was like, this is overrated.
Yeah, those, whatever it is, those, I feel like there's a series of self-published books about your perfect morning routine. And it's, well, what if you have a late night, or what if your kid's up, or what if anything, or you have an early meeting, and then you feel the shame of not completing your routine.
There's also seasons.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, the same routine isn't going to work in every season. Come on.
Okay, next one. This one's not over underrated, but either or. A heavily padded yoga mat with a thick layer, or a really slim one. Which would you prefer?
I would prefer slim with like props that I can use under my knees or things like that, because it's really hard to like balance on a really thick one. And also, like when you're in down dog or tabletop or those sort of things, it's like a lot of pressure on the joints with the squishy underneath. I think it's that, actually not as good for the joints.
Okay. Next one, another kind of bath, sound baths.
I think they're overrated. I like sound is amazing. I love chanting. I'm into the bowls and stuff like that. I'm into it and I love music, but I just can't handle it. It's a little too much. And I think that too, if someone really knows what they're doing, then it's great. But I feel like every yoga teacher just thinks they're a sound bath healer too, all of a sudden. And I just went to a class out of town, not in Fresno, a couple weeks ago. And the dude at the end, it was like satire, almost like your story of the woman being like, honey, like you're sweaty, do child's pose. That almost seems like it should be like a joke or a bit or a reel making fun of yoga teachers. I can't believe that really happened.
Yeah.
But this guy was like a satire, almost it felt. And it was crazy. Like the bowls, they were just so loud. His feet, his steps were really loud. I was scared he was gonna drop the thing on me. And then it was like bowls. And he did a bunch of different like multi-instrument and like the rain stick, but was like was
So
not did not
he was auditioning for Portlandia, is what you're saying.
Oh my gosh, it was terrifying. Not
Okay.
relaxing at all.
Next one, a yoga position, revolved half moon, over underrated. You see it a lot.
Revolved half moon. I think overrated.
Yeah. Why?
I think it's overrated because of how much people will teach it without ever actually teaching like a revolved triangle or something like that, which I find is much more harder, but an amazing prep to know. Now let's remove a point of contact. It's like, how about we like figure out how to rotate from our spine with both feet on the ground before like floating and flying and all these kinds of things. A revolved triangle is a lot more physically demanding, and that's probably why it doesn't happen. But yeah, I think it's overrated, but it's fun. I like
Yeah, me
it.
too. Meditation apps. What do you think?
No, I think this was kind of stumping me a little bit.
Because you talked about meditation, and meditation is a solitary practice in some ways, but the
Yeah.
appification of everything, I think, has turned things into games more than practices.
Yeah, it's like a
And so for me, I
gamifying
think
it.
I use one, but I think it's still pretty overrated in terms of developing a spiritual practice.
Yeah, I do think it's overrated. And at the same time, if that is like a doorway into getting someone who is like, for instance, like maybe a very heavy screen person or something like that, and that can be a doorway, then that's great. I just don't know how much that's actually happening. For someone who is of the mindset as you are and you use the app, it's one thing. But if,
So this next one's kind of in that flavor. Minimalist running shoes with little support. You think those are over or underrated? I'll confess to you, I've been running in Vibrams for almost 12 years. My wife was convinced that I was going to break my foot eventually. It has not happened yet. What do you think of them?
I think that for a minute they were overrated, not because the zero drop or the minimalist running shoes are overrated like outright, but I think what people don't realize is that you have to start out really slow, build into it. And so people go from wearing regular old running shoes or whatever to like the zero drops and then try to run like a half marathon in them. And they're like, my legs are destroyed and it's, or my feet. And I think that they're amazing for like proper form and all that kind of thing. But I do think that there's something that people don't realize. You really have to, you're in the long haul with adapting to that. There's obviously like tribes in Mexico and Argentina that they run barefoot or with sandals and things like that for hundreds and hundreds of miles. So I think it's really awesome. But yeah, I think as long as you are doing it the appropriate way, some of the big thick shoes are getting a little out of control. And I do those for a lot of miles, but I like somewhere like mid-range. If I'm running less than 8 miles, I don't want to wear Hokas or things with big squishy. I prefer to feel the ground underneath my feet. But if I'm doing anything over like a marathon, I'm for sure wanting those big, huge shoes.
It makes sense. It's if you are going to get involved with minimalist shoes, it has to be somewhat of a monogamous relationship. You really have to spend some time and get to know each other, hang out for a while, because it, I will confess, and I was running with them for a long time by the time I did this, but I did that Yosemite half marathon, which is all downhill in Vibrams. And I don't think I walked for 3 days because there was no heel support. So it was just like slapping. I was like playing bongo drums on the cement, which is not safe. Okay, two more handstands.
They are, I think they went overrated and now they're underrated. They went overrated and then now all your handstands aren't yoga. Yoga isn't a handstand. I'm like, bitch, if you could do a handstand, you wouldn't be saying that.
That's perfect
They're
response.
so fun.
Perfect
They're
response.
so
Yeah.
fun. I'm not any closer to enlightenment. It hasn't improved my internal like experience of living like so much that I don't need any other posture, obviously, but I love handstands, so underrated now.
Fantastic. All right. Last one. Some of the most commonly purchased mats. I'm curious. Manducas. Do you think those are over or underrated as mats?
They are probably overrated. I have a little like bias towards them because one of my early teachers was the founder and creator of Manduka. And he's like from here, and I trained with him. He sold it maybe like 10 or 12 years ago or whatever. But I will say I've tried to go to different mats several times, and I just don't like them as much. And I don't know if it's because I have some sort of personal attachment to the Manduka, but they're just solid. They've stood the test of time. They last forever. They have different thicknesses and a big one, a long one. And as a yoga studio owner, they make it really easy to order, like wholesale and that kind of stuff. Some of these other places are a little bit more difficult to work with. We've looked into it. But, and especially, I think it works both for the heated stuff. It doesn't just soak up all of the sweat and then stay wet and sopping. I see some people leave with their mats and I'm just like, oh, it doesn't look like
Yeah.
dry.
like there's something growing.
They also work really good for the non-heated stuff too. I've seen some of the other styles that are cool and interesting and the cork ones and stuff like that, but I'm a Manduka person for sure.
Yeah. Let's switch gears for a second and talk about running, which is something that I've been doing for as long as I can remember. Where do you want your heart rate when you're doing a long run?
This would be a really good question for my husband because he is all into these sort of metrics and stuff like that. He even bought me like a Coros heart rate monitor to go with my watch and stuff. But
there you go.
I have no idea. I want, just on feeling, mm-hmm. I want to be able to, if I can feel my heart beating in my chest, I want to slow down. So it's almost like that edge, like I was talking about between effort and ease. And I'm definitely pushing a little towards more of the effort side than the ease side. So I'm go mode until I start feeling like my heart beating in my chest. And then I know it's like time to take it down one click, like two clicks. I have these own metrics in my mind. If I am knowing that I'm running a long, for instance, on Saturday, I have a long run, then I want to feel like I can have a conversation, even if I'm not running with someone, but I want to be at conversational pace. I want to feel like I can look around and enjoy my surroundings, as to where like last night I went on a run with my husband and it was a shorter 4 mile run. And it was like, we were compromising. He was running a little slower than he wanted to. I was running a little faster than I wanted to. And it was conversational, but difficult, one word answers. And my heart wasn't, I couldn't necessarily feel like beating out of my chest, but I was like just on the edge of that happening. So I can do that for probably up into a 10K. And then after that, it's okay. I don't want a red line for more than 6 miles.
That makes sense. Do you think people should avoid running on asphalt?
Not necessarily. Again, though, I think that form is really important. Having the correct shoes and like doing the prehab and the rehab of stretching and all that kind of stuff. And if you are running on asphalt, then for sure, it's just making sure that you have appropriate knowledge and footwear of how to like keep your joints and your body safe and all that good stuff.
How do you maintain good form if you're running by yourself?
Ooh, that's a really good question. Because there's no one to call you out.
And lots of people run by themselves early in the morning before work or whatever.
I listen to my footsteps. Mm-hmm. If you're listening to music, then maybe it's turn it down for a little bit, that kind of thing. That's one thing I know, telltale sign. I can tell if there's pounding or slapping or something like that. It's okay, whoa, push off your big toe. And I also think that having just that intention, so maybe you do have an accountability friend, coach, or like something like that, where you have someone check your gait out, and then maybe you have like personal check-ins you can develop that way. That's a really good question. I run a lot by myself and with other people. And I do get a lot of coaching from my husband because he has no problem pointing out things that I'm doing right or wrong.
Oh, nothing about that.
So a little, I'm like, you're not my coach. But then when I'm running by myself, I'm like, what'd he say? Lean forward.
Let's say I gave you the option to have either really strong thighs or really strong calves. Which would you choose?
Personally, thighs, because my calves are huge. My calves are huge. I'm wearing skinny jeans right now and they're like bulging. Can you see? Look how big.
Those are sturdy calves for sure.
But biomechanically speaking, I just know that like my quad, the stronger my quads are, the, of course, tighter things are going to be. But if my quads are strong and open, my knees are good. My knees are good. And I care about my knees a lot.
For people that regularly run races, how often do you think people should run marathons? Is there a point in which not only diminishing returns, but you can also hurt yourself for the long term?
I think it depends on how someone, first of all, trains for the marathon and then their recovery after. I think if someone is very well trained and they give themselves an appropriate time to recover for them, and maybe even go into like a cross training kind of mode, like right after that. And if they're fortunate and resourced enough to be able to get blood work done and things like that checked, then I don't think that doing more than one marathon a year kind of old school thing is like horrible on your body. I just, like you just said, it depends is like the huge thing. And it's going to depend on the person. But I think if you're the kind of person that, you know, does some runs, but doesn't have a very specific like training program before, you just get in there and grind it out and suffer your way through it. And then, you know, say you take a few days off, like I wouldn't go and do a marathon like the next month or something from that kind of way. But if you're someone who's thoughtful and you're sleeping well and you're eating well and you are super trained for it, like, yeah, give yourself some time after. And then I don't see why not. But I might be on like that other side of it because I race semi often and like lots of miles. And but I think because I am not just a runner, like I hike, I ride my bike, I do yoga, I boat. We're huge boaters. We do pack rafting and stuff like that on whitewater. So I never get to like, I feel like, oh, I could probably be a much better runner or boater if I just stuck with it, circling back to the beginning of the conversation. But I like all of these things and they're ways for me to explore the nature and myself and all these kinds of things. So I just feel like I'm pretty decent at like all those things and pretty
I feel like, not to interrupt you, but I feel like that's like a broad life philosophy choice that a lot of us have to make, because we can really specialize in one thing and we're much more marketable in terms, like we're as a commodity, we're more rare because we're specialized. And I think that's capitalism in a lot of ways. But then there's the other life philosophy, which is like, just enjoy dabbling. And like the dabbling thing, I think doesn't have as high a status in our culture, but I think it is probably the best thing for a human and thinking outside the market. Now, I said that all to say, because we're transitioning to business related questions, because owning a studio is owning a business. So I have a number of questions about the business side before we wrap up. Is it an advantage or a disadvantage to have a yoga studio next to a bar?
Both.
Okay. Can you list the advantage and disadvantages?
The advantages is that there's a space where like people after class can go and hang out. And there's also kombuchas and there's like even non-alcoholic things. But yeah, people like to go and have a beer and continue their conversation or whatever. And it provides this space for like community to be together, like outside of the 1 hour class that they go to. And I think that's really cool. I think that disadvantage is that if someone is trying to make certain like lifestyle choices, and that would be like a really big
yeah, that's a good point. Someone's trying to get on a healthy track and they have to walk near a bar, they're like,
smoking, hanging out and whatever, so that can be like a little intense. And then just not to mention too, like it's different mentalities, but we've had people who've gone to the like bar next door for years and then just been like, you know what, one day I just thought, why don't I just go to yoga before I go to the bar? These are the like almost bar fly types too that have come in. So yeah, we have people that would have never, ever entered a yoga studio, but they just got so comfortable in talking to people a little bit, going in and out, and just the last person you'd think of who come pretty regularly now. And then vice versa, like I've seen people who are like really almost introverted, like super shy. There's been times where I'm like walking to my car and it's maybe I taught a couple classes and they're hang out and laughing and talking with people like hours later. And I'm like, whoa, that I've never even heard them say more than even if I'm like, hi, how are you? How was your day? Trying to get it out of them there. So I'm like, oh my goodness, that's so cool. Yeah.
Let's talk about churn a little bit. Ideally, if you operate a studio, you would want everyone to have a membership because it would be better for you in terms of being able to predict future revenue. But that's just not the case because people are always cycling through different fitness habits and trends and whatever else. If you're talking to someone that's about to open a yoga studio for themselves, what would you tell them that they should aim for in terms of membership amongst the general business that they do? What's the point at which you start to feel comfortable, like where you can have a consistent expectation of who's going to come and expected revenue?
Are you talking about like amount of members?
Yeah. So percentage of people that are one-off classes versus people that are paying monthly to come to yoga.
Yeah. Like you already named it, like the comfort level for predictability to know, okay, we're gonna be able to like pay like the staff and like the rent and all these kinds of things. It's like those auto renew and those kinds of memberships are like, they feel safer because there's that predictability about it. But I think as long as that is the bulk, then it's pretty good. And sometimes I'm not as much of the numbers person as like my husband is, can make quite a bit off of like the one-off kind of stuff, but it doesn't feel as safe. It's more volatile, obviously. And so even if in theory it's, oh yeah, what if you could actually make a lot more if everyone just paid drop-ins. If literally every person who came through our studios like every day just paid a drop-in, we'd make a lot more.
Because you get volume discounts, right? Typically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's just, like I said, it's that volatile nature of it is really scary. So you get a trade-off when people do the memberships. And then plus it gives them a discount. Not a discount, that's a weird word to say, but it gives them
a reward for loyalty, if you will. So on that same note, I'm curious, and I haven't asked a yoga person on this podcast this question before, but I'm curious about the yoga teacher market in Fresno. I know a lot of people do it as a side job. They're bivocational. How hard is it to find and retain new teachers?
It has not been difficult for us. The only time it was difficult was post-pandemic.
Okay.
I think it was across lots of industries where it was just like hard to find people to come back to work. So that was difficult for a little while, but that's actually in the 6 years we've been open, the only time that was difficult. If there's a need, there's always already kind of someone that's been like, hey, I'd love to teach for you. So while we put out a lot of call to action for like support staff that work at our desk or do things like that, we've never actually, besides that pandemic moment, had to be like, we need teachers, come teach. And we retain teachers for quite a while too. Usually if someone's leaving, it's because they're moving or something like that's going on. There's been a couple unfortunate situations where there wasn't an alignment anymore, which even yoga teachers are humans. And someone was like, oh, I bet there's never any drama like at the yoga studio. I was like,
nope, it's generally they're staffed by humans. So then you get drama.
Yeah.
So can you take a 20,000 foot perspective and describe what in terms of the yoga studio landscape of Fresno? Because there's a few different studios across town. And I was just curious, like, your perspective on the landscape. And then what makes Tower Yoga unique within the kind of the broader landscape of yoga studios in Fresno?
Yeah, that's interesting. I used to teach at a lot of places before we opened here. And I never taught at Old Town or Four Corners, but I know both Leanna and Desi, and I've gone to their studios and talked to them on the phone and things like that. So I'm privy to a lot. What makes Tower Yoga unique is it's built into like even the location where we are, that I think that it's, to me, and especially someone who like goes to a lot of studios when I travel out of town or in California even and things like that, in some ways we fit stereotypes for sure, but I just feel like it feels less stereotypical than other kind of places I've been to. And yeah, not saying that in a negative way or anything like that, but there's a lot of like norms that I'm used to from teaching in a lot of studios and teaching for so long that I think we have dropped altogether or just evolved from, if that makes sense. And we're not afraid to go in a little bit of a different direction with things and do things differently if it seems like that makes sense. So I do think that that makes it unique. I don't know. I have friends who move and they're just like, man, I have their studios I go to and I like them, but it's just not Tower Yoga. And I'm still trying to like put my finger on what is that? Because I feel like, yeah, there was like a community vibe in other places I've taught and places I go, but there's just something different here. You have to experience it to feel it, I think. Part of it is because we do allow ourselves to go tunnel vision and make choices, not like without having any consideration of what's happening in other places, because you always want to have your finger on a pulse to a certain degree. But I think we're just like, what feels right to us though? What does it seem like? Who cares if it's never been done or if that's going in a different direction or if that's different or whatever? Like I said, it's not like we're some complete, totally disrupting the industry. It's not like we're doing everything completely bananas backwards, but we have made a lot of decisions to do things differently because that's just what feels right, even though that's not how it's typically done. And that seems to by and large go over well. Sometimes it doesn't at all and we have to pedal super hard. But yeah, I don't know. We're speaking of that. Yeah, you might see one of my husband are at the bar having a beer with someone, but we're not also trying to, I think, perform or fit a role or come off a certain way. Definitely. Yeah.
But sounds like you're describing Tower in a lot of ways too. So it's really seems like symbiotic between the culture of the community and then what you guys do, which makes sense, which means that you're in a lot of ways a wonderful neighborhood studio that kind of meets the people that live there right where they are. I ask all my guests this question. I'm always curious about how people's professions or what they do affects the way they see a city. So how do you think being a yoga teacher changes the way Fresno?
Oh, it's making me think. Started teaching when I was 21 and I'm 36 now. So in a lot of ways, like my prefrontal cortex wasn't even developed like when I started teaching. So I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I think that because it's been a part of the way I filter and part of my world view for so long that it does take me aback when people are surprised by what we have going on or what I'm a part of or things happening in my community that I'm like, why would that take you off guard? Or yeah, of course there's people that like think like this, or of course we do that. Or, and yeah. In those moments I can see, oh, I don't have whatever viewpoint of like Fresno is there from the outside looking in, or even from people who live here but don't practice, or they're not in this, the kind of bubble. So I don't know. And there's probably pros and cons to that, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. We always close our conversations with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
Like around yoga?
Anything you want.
Oh, yeah. Some good yoga books are Eastern Body, Western Mind from Anadeya Judith. That's a cross between psychology and the chakra system. And it's really cool. And Tantra of the Yoga Sutras by Alan Finger is a really good kind of commentary and like brief translation on the Yoga Sutras from a tantric perspective. It's really like digestible. And another one on the sutras is, it's The Path of the Sutras. It's from Nikolai Bachman. And he doesn't go through the sutras like thread by thread and comment on it. He more so just defines and gives examples of some of the concepts. So that's a good one. And Yoga Body is actually a really good book too. It's more academic. It's super dense, but it gets into the history of like classical yoga from the origins, if you will, with the physical practice. And that was really eye-opening for me when I read it like 2011, 2012. And yeah, so those are some good ones.
To close, what's going on at Tower Yoga this month or so? Any upcoming events, any things going on that people should know about if they're interested in coming to a class? Is there a class you'd recommend for them to pop into first as an introduction?
Okay, we are rounding out the month. And so I think for January, we have some like special kind of events going on. We actually have a collaboration with Valley Girls Run, and you can follow them at Valley Girls Run and they'll give the info for it, but one of us will usually lead some yoga with that run, and they usually do 3 miles. And we're thinking about putting together some sort of like snow day thing all together. And we have another workshop at the end of the month. We're collaborating with one of our members who will be facilitating like a cacao ceremony at the end of January, and like a kind of primal flow sort of different movement style. We're actually starting our next round of teacher training, a 200-hour teacher training in like mid-January. So that's like a big thing going on. But we'll have more events and stuff like that coming up. So just, you can check us out on Instagram or check out our website. And we have those like extra events we do. As far as coming into a class, if you're a student who's never been to the studio, we have a free week of yoga for every new student. And it's good at both of our locations. So we have a hot studio connected to Goldstein's. It's on Wishon and Tower. And then just around the corner, we have a non-heated yoga studio that's connected to Component Coffee. And the free week is good at both locations. So you can try both. At the hot studio, we have showers and all that kind of stuff. But you can look it up, and we have a lot of different styles. There's descriptions, there's bios of the teachers, all that kind of thing. But we really encourage people to use that week to try both locations, lots of styles, as much as you can in that week to see if this is a place that feels right to you. And that's the other thing too, is anybody can come and try. Is our studio for everyone? No, of course not. And that's why it's really good that there are so many studios in general, but like even in Fresno and Clovis, because I realize like we aren't going to speak and be like the perfect place for every single person and like vice versa. So it's good. But yeah, that's like where I would say. And as I said too, there are all those descriptions and stuff like that. If you end up like being like, I just really need help making a decision. If you email us, our email's connected to our website and all that kind of stuff, then we can help you make that decision. You can give us a call. We'll call you back. If after reading all the descriptions and stuff, you're like, I still don't know. Just, yeah, contact us and we'll help you out for sure.
Awesome. Kelly, I love this conversation so much. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. And I think developing a good yoga practice is so important for not only your long-term health, flexibility, all those kinds of things, but really as a dedicated spiritual practice for a lot of people. Yeah, I would encourage people to check it out if they've never tried, and it can really be life-changing. So thank you for the work you do, and thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/FresnosBest. We'll see you next time.